If you'd like to listen to our podcasts without ads, please consider becoming a member. In addition to no ads, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows, an invitation to join the DSR Slack community, access to our Discord community, enhanced show notes for select shows, and more. For this week only, get 50% off the first year or the first month of membership. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and use code ECLIPSE to receive the discount. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code ECLIPSE. Thank you very much for your support.
Nine, 12, 10, 28, 2, 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world. Once every 6 weeks or so, we try to do a high-level discussion with a cabinet-level official from the government, get a little bit of audience interaction going on, and we are extremely delighted to have with us Secretary of Transportation Buttigieg here. We started high-level discussions of this sort, I don't know, 6, 8 years ago, and at the very first one of those discussions, there was this mayor from the Midwest that it was attracting a lot of attention, and now you're here again. So welcome very much. Glad to have you here.
Well, thanks for having me.
So what we'll do is we'll talk for about 30 minutes, and then we'll have some Q&A. So get ready for that. Someone will come around with a microphone, give you a chance to talk. Let me turn it to Mike. Mike can kick it off.
Wasn't ready for that. Okay, Mr. Secretary, good evening. Well, let's start with what is to me the obvious thing that was recently and still is to some extent in the news, which is the Francis Scott Key Bridge. A couple of questions around that. Describe your morning when you got the phone call and what that was like. Talk a little bit about what that incident says about, you know, both our highway infrastructure and about container shipping and what needs to be fixed. And then tell us the date that the new Francis Scott Key Bridge is going to be.
I don't think I'll get to make that news today, but obviously it's something we've been very engaged in from day one. You know, the last thing I do before I go to sleep is turn on the ringer on my work phone. And I remember getting into bed and thinking, did I turn the ringer on? Getting back out of bed, going across the room to the dresser where I put my phone, flicking the ringer on, going back into bed. And then, of course, a few hours later, waking up to that news and then the shocking video and image minutes later, being on the phone with the White House, with Governor Moore, the mayor, and others. And what I'll say is, as horrible as that situation was, it also really brought out the best in people, both in terms of the way the community of Baltimore responded, certainly the leadership of Governor Moore, but also a lot of different federal agencies working together that haven't always had occasion to do that. Coast Guard, Army Corps of Engineers, us, Department of Labor even involved because of the impact on the jobs of the workers who are in the port. The important thing to understand about the Port of Baltimore, even though it was not one of the top 3 or 5 container shipping ports, it is uniquely set up to handle vehicle shipping. It's our number one vehicle handling port in the U.S., so much so that there are facilities on the grounds of the port that actually complete some of the processes of manufacturing cars, some of those finishing touches. And nearly all of the port was blocked by the wreckage of that bridge. I was just notified today that a 560-ton piece of the bridge has come out of the channel, which is one of the things that most stood in the way of getting a temporary channel that's going to be about 35 feet deep, 280 wide open. That will be an important intermediate step toward getting the full channel open, which the Army Corps hopes to achieve.
That's not quite deep enough for container ships? Or?
Depends on the ship. Yeah. And ultimately, it'll be down to the Coast Guard to certify what will be eligible. But you really need the full channel open.
Yeah.
Because some of those bigger ships that were bigger than what was even contemplated when the Francis Scott Key Bridge was built in the 70s, are now routinely going through those channels, the what they now call the Neo-Panamax variety of ships, which are built to just barely fit into the Panama Canal in its newer dimensions.
Right.
All of which is to say, while it's been a big disruption to shipping in the region, it's remarkable to see how quickly we hope that will be fully back up and running by the end of May. The piece you mentioned, which will take much longer, is getting that bridge back. What we know is that the new bridge is going to be different than the old bridge. You're not going to build a bridge in the 2020s, according to the state of the art of the 1970s. and that the original bridge took 5 years, so it's not going to be something that happens overnight. It's going to require, I think, a lot of creativity, innovation to make it move as quickly as it could without getting into all the guts of transportation infrastructure procurement. It will use a process called progressive design build, which is a quicker way to get infrastructure done than traditional models where you have the thing fully cooked and then you go out and start bidding the construction of it. What that should enable is a swifter process. We've already put $60 million out to help with the early stages of that, but that is a fraction of what this is going to cost.
Sure.
And the president has pledged that the federal government will front all of the funding needed to get that up, with, of course, the important caveat that there may and likely will be a process of recovery from any private party that might be held liable.
Of course. Thank you.
One of the things, I mean, the Biden administration has been extraordinarily productive. One of the things the president has done, doesn't get enough credit for, is taking cabinet agencies that were not often always central and making them. I used to work in the Commerce Department, which is a backwater. Now Gina Raimondo is in charge of sort of the cutting edge of competitiveness. And the Transportation Department is at one of those moments, kind of apogee in its history.
Yeah.
Under you, because you've got this infrastructure bill, parts of the Inflation Reduction Act, that essentially have us doing the biggest investment in our transportation infrastructure since the Eisenhower administration.
Yep.
I think it's up to 51,000 projects now.
Yeah.
And you were just in the Southwest announcing one of the coolest, so maybe
we'll
start
there. Yeah, yesterday was a great day. We were in Las Vegas marking the beginning of U.S. high-speed rail in many ways. So the Brightline West project that we celebrated yesterday, we contributed $6.5 billion of loans and grants through the president's infrastructure plan. Plans to serve a Las Vegas to Southern California route, and they plan to be open by the end of 2028. So in the second term of the Biden presidency, Americans can be in a seat buying a ticket on actual high-speed rail, which I think is doubly important. First of all, it's just very exciting that the number of cars that's going to take off the road along a stretch of I-15 that is notoriously congested is a win in and of itself. But also, I'm convinced that when that happens, there will be no going back. Because, I mean, so many people travel abroad, and they have that experience of seeing what they have in Japan, for example. I saw that last year when we went out to the G7. We had to take the bullet train to get to where our meetings were held with the other transportation ministers. And so many Americans come back thinking, why can't we have nice things, right? You see that. And not even a Japanese standard, but, a Spanish or Turkish or Moroccan standard of high-speed rail. They're working on this in Uzbekistan. I mean, we should be leading on this, and we haven't been. But now we're getting in the game in a big way. And so instead of having to go to Japan or somewhere else to see this, I think anybody who comes back from Las Vegas, which is a lot of people from a lot of places in the United States, will say, why can't we have this in the Midwest? Why can't we have this in Texas? Why can't we have this in the Pacific Northwest? And that will create a level of demand and a level of expectation. while also creating a level of expertise in the U.S. about how to do this. One of the reasons why it's been so hard, one of the reasons why it's been particularly difficult for the other high-speed rail project that's already in construction in earnest, which is the North-South effort in California that's also very much underway, is that we haven't done this as a country. We don't have the cadres of engineers and project managers people in industry or government who know what it's like to build and launch a high-speed rail line. Now we will.
I don't want to make this political. But
don't get me in trouble.
And I won't. But the opposition party, they don't seem to like high-speed rail. They don't like light rail. They got a problem with why is that?
I don't know, but I'll tell you, whenever I encounter that, and I do, I often encounter it when I'm testifying on Capitol Hill, I try to respond in terms that I would hope they would appreciate, which is that if you believe that the U.S. ought to lead, if you believe in the U.S. having the best in everything, if you believe that the U.S. Should always aspire to be the greatest country in the world, why wouldn't we have the greatest high-speed rail in the world? Why should we have inferior service on one of the most important modes of transportation? Another thing that comes up is this kind of fiction that rail should pay for itself, and because it generally doesn't, it must be inferior, as though driving pays for itself. Of course it doesn't. I mean, there's a huge amount of investment, much of it from us, that goes into making sure that roads and bridges are in good shape. And the economic development you unlock makes it more than a good bet for society. And that was even before we knew what the climate implications were, which are also massive and positive for rail. The other thing I would say, I mean, I read I think it came from the Cato Institute of all places, a libertarian or conservative attack, it was either Cato or Heritage, on the principle of rail, bemoaning the fact that, and entering as kind of a critique against passenger rail, the fact that tickets on the Northeast Corridor on Amtrak were sometimes more expensive than airfares. Now, as a passenger, I would love for it to be as cheap as possible. But if you are a free market type, the fact that people are willing to pay not just the same but more for a train ride than for a plane ride over the same distance should be telling you something, that the market is telling you that this is a better way to cover a distance that is either a short plane ride or a long drive. And there are so many city pairs around America, many of them, by the way, in so-called red America, that are excellent candidates for high-speed rail because they have precisely this, a pair of cities that is an uncomfortably long drive or a weirdly short flight, and therefore would be an excellent, excellent candidate for high-speed rail.
You know, he does this on Fox all the time. He goes on, they ask him hard questions, and you've become the master of responding. No, the absolute master. But maybe, Mike, you have a tough question.
Here's my question, and I think it's a question that is probably on the minds of a lot of people sitting here with us. A high-speed rail project from Las Vegas to Los Angeles is great. We're all for it. But what about the Northeast Corridor? Now, I'm gonna preface this question with a little story.
You sound like my boss.
All right. Well, that's a good thing in this case. My little story is about the Beatles, and I promise I'm going to make this relevant. I was reading a book a few years ago about the Beatles' first trip to America. They were in New York, of course, at Ed Sullivan, and their first concert was here at what was then called the Washington Coliseum. It's where that REI store is now. They took a train because it was too snowy for them to fly, and I'm reading along about this, and it mentions their 2-hour and 15-minute train ride from New York to Washington. The Acela is slower than a 1964 train.
Yep.
So why, and when might we see high-speed rail between Washington and New York, or Washington and Boston, and how much time might a Washington to New York trip someday in our dreams take?
So one would hope that we can get it at least back to below the amount of time that it took back then. Part of the answer, not to be flip about it, is that there's more things between those cities than there used to be.
Right.
And it means anything like, for example, straightening out a curve. The right-of-way that goes into that goes through some of those complex and expensive real estate in the United States.
Right.
You add to that some of the legacy issues. Frankly, the big challenge we have on the Northeast Corridor before we get to pursuing your and my dream of and the president's dream of faster and faster connections up and down the Northeast Corridor is just taking care of what we've got. We're redoing the Hudson River tunnels. hundreds of thousands of passengers a day count on these tunnels. They represent the finest up-to-date engineering of the Roosevelt administration, the Teddy Roosevelt administration. Wow. We're talking about more than 100 years old, and damage compounded by Superstorm Sandy meant that they are even more compromised. And there was just no way to fund restoring those tunnels. Now, they will be not only restored, but augmented. There's new tunnels, old tunnels. It's arguably the biggest public works transportation project east of the Mississippi in my lifetime. But that's just to keep what we have going and then add some frequency. The Portal North Bridge, similar. The current bridge is a swing bridge, and it doesn't quite swing exactly all the way, which means they have to come out with sledgehammers to move it fully into alignment. Not optimal for today's Northeast Corridor. So the solution, obviously, is a bridge with no moving parts that's much higher so that maritime traffic can go under it, which is exactly what we're doing, but it takes about $1 billion, and the funding just wasn't there. So we've got a state of good repair backlog. But the good news is that backlog is finally shrinking rather than growing. The bad news is it will be a while before we're all the way done with it. But in the meantime, we are finding even just sometimes 30 seconds here, 30 seconds there, little ways to address the trip time. And piece by piece are going to make it better and better. Plus, new train sets coming in for the Acela line that will also make a difference.
You know, it's interesting just listening to you that recently in the press there's been a little bit of a discussion about, is it a good idea for the president to be out there talking about all this infrastructure? You know, and yet when you talk about each one of these things to some group of people, it's highly personal.
Totally.
Literally, as I was coming, I was talking to a friend of mine, Bob LaRusso here, who drives to Massachusetts, and he's like, where are the charging stations? I have an electric car. Yep. This is a problem for me. I was talking to some other folks who came up here from Atlanta on the overnight train.
All right.
And they're like, what? There they are. And then
hope you had a good ride.
And they're like, what is going on with this? And anybody who goes on the Excel, of course, the first question is, when are you going to fix the Wi-Fi? So, it's a very personal.
I sent a note to my team when I was on the train taking us into Kyiv from the Polish border, where the internet was working very well, saying, it should be at least this good back home. What can we do about that?
But just, as to the political resonance of this, you go out there, you talk about it more than anybody else. A lot of this stuff is deeply personal. It's not abstract, right?
Absolutely. I mean, all of us experience transportation. Everybody's an expert in transportation. And I'd say that with a chuckle, but it's actually true. Everybody's an expert in what transportation means to them because every one of us knows what our commute is like. Parenting, the older your kids get, is largely a matter of transportation. People's jobs and opportunities depend on transportation. So there's this intimately important thing that affects everybody's life, whether you are professionally involved in transportation or not. And by the way, it's also a life or death issue that reveals some of the weaknesses in our rationality as human beings. And what I mean by that is there are some areas where we are rightly very attuned to safety. I'll take aviation as an example, where we are rethinking some of our very frameworks for aviation oversight because of an incident where someone could have been hurt or killed. Could have been seriously injured or killed in with Alaska Airlines. And meanwhile, very little attention is paid to roadway safety, where we're in crisis, finally have things moving in the right direction, but not quickly enough. And where the 1% reduction we saw in roadway deaths last year represents about 2 or 3 airliners full of people who didn't die. And there's no notice to that. So it's a strange thing how we relate to transportation, but everybody experiences it in some ways. And everything from our greatest adventures to our most mundane commutes is at stake in transportation. In terms of the kind of political salience of it, I think the challenge we have is when we get something done and it goes well, almost by design, you're not supposed to have to think about it that much. This is how public works are more generally. When I was mayor, I used to go see our waterworks employees from time to time, and I'd tell them, look, the better job you're doing, the less I'm going to hear it. Nobody's ever going to barge through the doors of the mayor's office demanding to see the boss and say, you know, I just want you to know that I went downstairs today and I turned on the tap in the kitchen and a glass of clean, safe drinking water came out and it did not poison my family or anything like that. And I just want to have you thank the guys at the waterworks for that civilizational achievement, right? It doesn't work that way. By design, because if you're not worried about drinking water, which should be routine, but as we've seen very cruelly is not always the case in the United States of America, which we're also doing something about in this administration, led by the EPA, then you can think about other things in life. So in some ways, we're leaning into trying to get transportation back into the background, actually, by making it not a headache. But when something is unambiguously good, it's also less likely to go viral. And so we have to go out of our way to draw attention to it, which is why we were doing the great event we did yesterday, complete with driving a ceremonial spike.
Did you do that?
Yeah. I don't know what the spike was being driven into, but it was a very nice effect. But honestly, most of the 50,000 projects you mentioned aren't getting that treatment. They're just going to make people better off, and we got to go out of our way to draw attention to it because it is good news.
Let's talk about cars and electrification and charging stations and the attempt to build up that infrastructure. What are the goals by, 2025, 2030, to have the automobile industry moving in much more in that direction?
The auto industry is moving in the direction of electric already, which begs the question, why bother with any policies around that? And the reason is there are three things that are not guaranteed to happen. One, will it happen quickly enough to help us meet our climate goals? Mm-hmm. Two, will it be accessible so that this is not just an elite first adopter concern, but that everybody gets the benefit, especially the money you can save if you have one of these things? And three, will this be a made in America electric vehicle revolution? Those three questions are very much in play right now, and they're what's at stake in things like the $7.5 billion we're committing to get chargers built across the country. The president's goal is to have 500,000 chargers out across the country by the end of this decade. That's what we think we'll need to add in order to really serve an EV economy as well.
And I'm sorry, can you tell, like, 500,000, that's a huge number, but what does that mean for somebody who's driving? Can you give a picture, for somebody who's driving from Detroit to St. Louis?
So it's important to consider the different types of chargers. So we're going to be we're launching the process of installing a lot of fast chargers across the country. These are the ones that are most similar to the experience of the gas station, a matter of minutes. You can charge your car. Part of the requirement we've set out as we work with the states that are ultimately getting most of these dollars out is you should never go more than 50 miles without coming upon a charger. It's the same way when you go out on a road trip today, you know that there's going to be a gas station somewhere between where you are and where you need to be. Then there's level two chargers. They take longer, but they're dramatically easier and less expensive to install. It makes sense to have those at a lot of locations, especially places you might be spending half an hour anyway, a place you're going to stop to eat or shop. And then there's the charging infrastructure that people don't know they already have if they have a single family home and a garage, which is the plug in your wall, which if you have all night, which many people often do for their cars, is adequate, but not when you're out on the road. And that doesn't do you much good if you're in a multifamily dwelling in a city where you don't have a garage or a single family home. That's why we have community charging to try to meet those places that the market can't or won't yet do. And these alternative fuel corridors around the country where we're making sure the states have those chargers. This is new. I mean, this is out of the 50-some new programs created for our department alone out of the president's infrastructure plan. This might be the most novel. And so it means it's been challenging to get those chargers into the ground. We're standing up an entire new multi-billion-dollar program. But we've seen the very first of those chargers actually get into the ground. And we'll see another handful in the coming months ramping up toward that goal of thousands and thousands being added through the decade so that there is that confidence that when you set out on a journey in an EV that you're going to never have to worry any more than we worry about not being able to find gas.
On your third point, just quickly, that competition to be the world leader, I assume, comes from China.
Yes, and it's important to note that the Trump administration allowed China to build a big advantage here. And part of this is being propelled by unfair practices on their part in terms of how they subsidize their their OEMs. But part of it's also that because the last administration didn't view it as important for America to win in this regard, didn't make some of the investments that we're now making. Now, the cruel irony of this is that I've seen what it means to allow America to fall behind on that, because I saw what happened when the Studebaker car company fell behind and went out of business 20 years before I was born. But I could tell by the time I was old enough to notice that it was the most important thing that had happened in the city I grew up in, because there were acres and acres of factories that looked as though they had been destroyed in war, that were just part of the scenery when I was going to school or getting around town. That's what happens when you can't innovate and keep up. And that's what's at stake for not just the industrial Midwest, but really whole swaths of America, if we don't make sure that this is a made in America EV revolution.
Let me pick up on something you brought up earlier. Well, Mike expires over here on our way. You okay?
I'm okay, and I assured everyone I tested negative.
Okay. You know, we're relieved.
Something's wrong.
But let me pick up on something else, because a lot of people take these things personally. And that is the aviation safety issue that you brought up. Clearly, something's broken at Boeing. Mm-hmm. And it has led to the CEO saying he's stepping down. Mm-hmm. And there have been whistleblower providing testimony that's kind of disturbing. And yet, at the same time, you know, there were a couple of those MAX crashes that did not result in real changes at Boeing, did not result in criminal prosecution of people. Something is deteriorating there, and yet the system doesn't seem to be squeezing them, and the CEO is able to say, well, I'll stick around for a year, and then I'll go. And there's something seems wrong about that, and I'm just wondering what your reaction is.
Yeah, I mean, FAA was very concerned about what they saw when they went out to Boeing, and have taken a step that I don't think has ever been taken before, which is to limit how many planes they can even make until they demonstrate that they can make them safely. And you know, that has consequences, but the consequences are economic, and we just have to live with those, because safety is everything else is multiplied by zero unless you're taking care of safety. I think it is not just an operational but a cultural problem. And I think that it's going to be necessary for any leadership there to be very responsive to that. Part of what happened was, or I should say part of what didn't happen, was the same kind of scrutiny and attention inside Boeing on the manufacturing side that there was on the design side. So what did come out of everything that happened after the 737 MAX crashes, owing not just to policy leadership, but really the extraordinary activism of families, some of whom I met with and had heartbreaking conversations about the impact on their families of the loss of life, was a lot of change in the evaluation of whether a design is safe. But what you have here is a separate thing, which the manufacturer also needs to be able to demonstrate, which is, did the plane that came off the line actually conform to that design? And obviously, you're only as safe as the match between what was produced and what was supposed to be produced, which is why we have Boeing under such a microscope and reevaluating FAA's own procedures and approaches. But I do think part of what's at stake here is to maintain an aviation safety record in this country that's extraordinary, that we need to regard not as a destination, but as a process that continually has to be refreshed, while we simultaneously get things like roadway safety and rail safety to be a little more like that very exacting culture that we've established as a country, such that just since this administration arrived, we've had about 3 billion occasions when a passenger has stepped onto an airliner, and every one of them has stepped back off since we got here, that I know of, at least in terms of, I'll put it another way, it's been 15 years now since there was a fatal airliner crash. And our challenge, and I don't just mean the government, the FAA, but the entire aviation sector, is to understand each year what has become the thing that most puts that record at risk, and then go after it.
In 8 minutes, we're going to start taking some questions from you. So I'd like you to think about that, and then we'll pass around the mic when we get there. So maybe one more question for Mike and then one more question for me.
Sure. I'll make this a fun question because I've always been a little bit of an infrastructure geek, and I guess you were. What's the coolest infrastructure thing you've learned in this job?
Wow. It is a great job for an infrastructure geek. And there have been a couple of moments from kicking the tires of a 747 literally, I got to do that once.
That's fun.
Fun fact, it's literally an 18-wheeler, if you do the math on the number of tires. Mm-hmm. All the way through to driving that spike in on the to celebrate the high-speed rail yesterday. But I got to tell you, a lot of things that move me most are smaller projects in smaller communities where you feel in a more visceral way mm-hmm. what it means to the community that it's happening. I was at one in Tell City, Indiana. This is the opposite end of Indiana from where I grew up, right opposite Kentucky across the Ohio River. And down the Ohio River come these barges with pig iron, the crude iron that they use in the foundry that accounts for 1,000 jobs, just up the hill from Tell City, which has all of 7,000 people. Mm-hmm. And their Port Authority, as you might imagine, is a volunteer body of community residents who mostly do their business, often do their business over a meal or a cup of coffee, and heroically have run this port, which effectively consisted of a crane on a barge, which meant that if the river's too low or the river's too high, doesn't work the way you need it to. Mm-hmm. And so with about $1.5 million, out of the very same program that we used to put, I think, 50 into on-dock rail at the Port of Long Beach to help with container shipping, also obviously very important, but here in southern Indiana, awarded them a grant that they're going to use to get that into a crane that's on land. And with that really changed the operations of that port that's never going to be national news.
Right.
But is everything to Perry County, Indiana. Mm. So the projects like that are some of the ones that actually stick with me the most, as much as the kind of whiz-bang, new tech, interesting stuff going on out there, which is also very cool. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It goes back to my point about it being personal. In college, I had this roommate who was a rail fan. You know about rail fans? And he would sit there, and he would be on the phone all night. I never could use the phone. I had no social life because he was on the phone all night. And he was talking to people across the country about which rail car had rolled into which station.
Oh, wow.
And they kept notebooks of like where all the trains were across the... Wow. It's insane. There are people who do that with planes, too. There's a law here in Washington now, you may not be familiar with it, that every conversation, no matter what it is, has to involve AI at a certain point.
Right. Surprised we lasted this long, actually.
And so let me turn it to the issue of autonomous vehicles, but both passenger vehicles and trucks, which have been promised.
Yeah.
And then there have been some fits and starts.
Yeah, I mean,
where are we? Where do you think we're going?
You know, 10 years ago, as a budding young mayor, I wound up chairing a new task force we created on automation. And it was clear to this group of mayors, or we were told as a group of mayors, that we could expect the widespread use of automated vehicles in 7 years. And it's been exactly 7 years away every year for the 10 years since we had those conversations. And yet, real things are happening. You're going to increasingly see here in D.C. the same kind of vehicles that anyone who's been to Phoenix may have noticed, these autonomous vehicles moving around. To me, what's most interesting, most important, and potentially most exciting about all of this is safety. Safety isn't just the reason to be very careful about AVs and how we regulate them, though it is. But it's also the potential on the other side, because human drivers of, at least of cars, it's a bit of a different story with truck drivers who are highly trained. But human car drivers have a murderous track record. I mean, again, you know, 40,000 people a year. It's the same as gun violence in terms of the loss of life in this country.
But you need a license to drive.
Yeah, well, yeah. And yet we lose 40,000 people a year. We need to have some step changes in what it's like to be a pedestrian, cyclist, or driver or passenger in a car, and this could provide some of those step changes. There already is in certain terms of some of the what's called ADAS, automated driver or advanced driver assistance technology. The problem is that some people treat it, and frankly, some firms market it as though it were driver replacement technology. It is not. There is no vehicle you can buy today, that does not require you to have your hands on the wheel and be actively involved in the driving task at all times. That cruise control, it is spiffy. It will help you, but it is designed to help you drive, not to let you not drive.
Well, there is one kind of vehicle, which people don't think about a lot. Commercial airliners.
Well, but even there, right?
But I'm just saying they're on autopilot. Yeah. A lot of the time you're in the air.
Yes, but the pilot is still supposed to be in great. But that, I mean, that's my point. I think people hear that word autopilot, and they think that means I can sit back and read the paper, have a cup of coffee, be on my goggles. My God, I don't know if you saw that viral video. Like, what are you doing? So all of which is to say, to me, what matters about this technology, or any technology, is not how cool it is. It's whether it's going to make a difference on the problems we're trying to solve. And the biggest problem we're trying to solve is safety. And that is precisely why we need to be careful to make sure that these new technologies earn public acceptance so that they can deploy safely. I'll mention one other thing about AI. And this is inspired a little bit by having looked at the most important transportation technology of the last decade, which turned out to be the smartphone. Not even a vehicle, right? Nobody would have guessed in the year 2000 if I said what's the most important transportation technology that the answer would have been the smartphone. But it's, think about it, it's changed everything. How you board a plane, how you navigate a city, how you get a bike, everything. And so we need to recognize that it'll be hard to see some of the most important use cases coming. And just to take one example, just today, I made a kind of cheeky comment to my own team as we were working through a process on how to accelerate the delivery of projects. I noticed this form that was being designed that I think could really help us in this process that we have about how grants are made. But I thought, you know, I'd like to know if one of these chatbots can just read a project description and fill out the form for you instead of us inflicting another form on a project sponsor. Some of the most interesting cases for AI may actually be turning it loose on our own administrativia in the government and in our department. Before you get into the more sexy applications related to flying cars or self-driving vehicles or anything else.
When I think about the unintended consequences, I once did some work with a car company that was trying to imagine the future. And it was, how do we, you know, have a greener future? And it was a whole discussion about different kinds of propulsion systems. What they didn't discuss was the fact that if you put a lot of sensors around a car, then the car wouldn't hit another car, and it didn't have to be as heavy. It didn't have to be made of the same materials. Yeah. And so consequently, AI, sensors, the vehicles that are reluctant to hit other vehicles actually have an environmental consequence, and it's a knock-on effect. All right, so let's see if there's some questions here. And I would like to encourage the first question to come from a woman, because I regret that this is a mannel, and we are strongly opposed to mannels. And all right, right here, there you go.
Hi, thank you for coming today. This has been a very interesting and enlightening. A lot of what we've talked so far is about catching up to other countries or reshoring up our infrastructure to make sure that it's safe for now into the future. Yeah. But if you were to imagine a future where we're not just trying to catch up, what does that look like for you?
Oh, I love that. Because I try to make sure we have enough bandwidth to do that, even as we're managing the legacy infrastructure and systems we have. I mean, again, I think the most important consideration is maybe the least glamorous, which is that it be safe. And we try to envision a future where everybody can safely get to where they are. I think it is absolutely within our potential, if not yet our grasp, to have the idea of losing your life on a roadway be as antiquated as the idea of dying of cholera on the Oregon Trail. It just seems like something from another period. And by the way, we also know that zero is achievable because we've seen places achieve it. And I don't just mean places abroad, although to the point of catching up, you know, there are Scandinavian cities of 500,000 that have gone a year with zero traffic deaths. But there are also American cities of 50,000 that have gone a year without traffic deaths. And if that's happened already, then I want to find the first community of 100,000 that'll have that result. I think that that future, it's safe. It's one where we're also just better using our land so that certain trips aren't as necessary or as long. And actually, another attractive potential payoff to some automated vehicle use scenarios is that less of our land is devoted to surface parking, which as a former mayor is especially tantalizing to me. Again, I know these don't sound like the most glamorous things. I mean, it's also neat to imagine that you can step into a eVTOL, these electric vehicle, vertical takeoff and landing, basically flying cars, and get to where you're going in 7 minutes instead of an hour. But to me, just the idea that we don't have that many parking lots anymore is pretty enticing, you know? And greener. Look, right now, transportation is the biggest sector in terms of contributing greenhouse gases in our economy. And to me, that's a call to aspire to be the biggest part of the solution. And while we're at it, break down the idea that it's always climate versus jobs, because we're creating good climate jobs when we get this right. So look, the truth is we are going to be keying off other countries in a lot of areas because we gave up our leadership position on things like auto safety or bullet trains. But I think we can lead on EVs. I think we can lead in a lot of aerospace applications that are coming out and the future of aviation. And I think we can lead in imagining what the future of active transportation looks like, which maybe is the most retro thing of all, just getting around on two legs or two wheels. But the better we get at that, the better the future actually looks.
Other questions? Yes. Right. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. A little more gloomy of a question. Given that infrastructure is the cornerstone of our capacity for innovation and economic prosperity, how are you and the Biden administration working to keep our transportation sector and infrastructure secure and safe from our adversaries and non-state actors?
Mm. Great question, one that we definitely talk about a lot in this administration. And a lot of it's recognizing that there are both conventional, traditional threats and novel ones. The more, for example, the bigger percentage of the value of a car becomes the computer, and that's getting bigger and bigger. The more you got to worry about cyber threats to that car, especially as it's not just transmitting telematics out there, but in some cases receiving signals that if it's getting the wrong signals, that's a really troubling thing. Here's the real challenge. We don't actually run most transportation systems at the federal level. The big exception is aviation. So with FAA, there's a whole set of things to protect the national airspace because we literally run the air traffic system. But we don't run highways. We fund them. We don't run railroads. We regulate them. And as the Colonial Pipeline incident, which is the first time I got a phone call from the Situation Room since I got this job, as that showed us, or reminded us, most of the critical infrastructure in this country is in private and or local hands, which means that it's not just a question about what we do federally to be a tougher target and batten down the hatches. We're doing that in the federal enterprise. But how do we engage the many, many local owners of infrastructure, make sure they are harder targets, make sure they know what their responsibilities are and their vulnerabilities are, and do it all without necessarily being able to read them in on all the threats that we're made aware of, although there are also ways to help make them more aware of some of the things that come in through the intelligence community. So it's a live concern, only becoming more so as some of these forms of technology that not everybody even completely understands play a bigger and bigger role in this. But what I can tell you is that very, very good people are on it.
You know, one of the questions Mike was talking about before, and we haven't really hit upon it, was East Palestine, mm. and what's been done in the follow-up to that. And I noticed just the other day that we're yep. changing the rules about number of people on these long trains
yes.
and so forth. So.
Yeah, so let me talk about what's been done. Let me talk then about the unfinished business. And I'll try to be brief, but it's hard because I'm pretty fired up about this. What's been done, tons of focused inspections, safety reviews and audits of all the major railroad companies, a real push on the conditions for workers, including going from about 5% to about 87% of union workers having access to sick leave in the railroading industry, advancements on technology rulemakings, including a rule, that the one you referenced, where you might be amazed to know this is not already a rule, but we issued a rule saying that generally on a train, especially a 2-mile long freight train, you got to have more than one person on board. Believe it or not, this was not a rule.
2 miles is how many cars?
I got to think of the mental math on that. We're talking about trains with more than 100 cars.
Yeah, often. Right.
So you might want to have more than two people on board. There were three people on board the train in East Palestine, and I think that fact may have been part of why nobody lost their life. I don't want to get ahead of any investigation still underway, but it matters to have people ready to respond. And two of the large Class 1 railroads immediately sued us, saying that we've gone way too far, way out of line, suggesting you got to have more than one human being on board a train. So all of which brings me to the unfinished business, which is that the Railway Safety Act is waiting its turn in Congress and has been since shortly after East Palestine, bipartisan, sponsored by J.D. Vance and Sherrod Brown both. It's got a bipartisan counterpart in the House, and it's just sitting there. And some of the same members of Congress who had a lot to say about East Palestine in the weeks after it happened are today completely ignoring the demands from leaders in East Palestine and elsewhere to finally pass this legislation that would, among other things, codify that minimum crew size so that it wasn't subject to some of the vulnerabilities. I recently learned that actually a member of Congress sponsored legislation to dismantle that two-person crew rule that we just put out already. But also things like fines. If we catch a railroad company in an egregious safety violation that gets somebody killed, the stiffest fine we can assess is in the neighborhood of $225,000. This is for a multi-billion-dollar company in one of the most profitable industries on earth. Not enough to change their behavior. The law would fix that. So my point is, I'm proud of the work that has been done in response to that horrible situation. But if we really want to do right by the people who live in East Palestine and anybody else who lives anywhere near a rail line, including an awful lot of people in South Bend, Indiana, where I grew up, Congress needs to get off the dime and pass this bill.
We have 3 minutes left, Mike. Do you have a final question?
No, let's take one more. Let's go to the audience.
All right, we'll go in the middle here.
Thank you, Secretary Buttigieg. I'm with the Project on Government Oversight, or POGO, and one of our primary issues of concern right now is Schedule F and efforts that we're likely to see under a future administration who tries to further politicize the federal civil service. And so I'd love to know what you would consider to be some of the threats, not to public servants, but to the public, that we are likely to see in terms of all of the services and benefits that we all rely on under such a patronage policy. And also, if you were speaking to ordinary citizens who are more susceptible to believing in drain the swamp politics, what would you most want them to know?
I mean, really, what I'd want them to know is the kind of people who work at a place like the USDOT. And out of the 55,000 employees we have, I think about 100 are political appointees, and the rest are career civil servants, public servants, from air traffic controllers to trucking inspectors to the people who run down the complaints if your airline stiffs you out of a refund, to geographers at the Federal Rail Administration. And what they do saves lives every day. And they do it without regard to politics. And I will say, you know, we were certainly not hit as hard as a department as some others by the ideological intensity of some previous administrations. But I will say that the very important parts of our department, including the Departmental Office of Civil Rights, which among other things makes sure that if your house is in the path of a proposed highway expansion and is about to be removed for that reason, that your rights are respected, doing pretty important work. And that office was not exactly being given the resources it needed when we got here. So this stuff does matter. I actually like that many dimensions of transportation don't have an obvious ideological valence. But as we've learned, just about anything can become ideological. We saw that with public health. And certain things that to me are just basic questions of transportation safety, like railroad regulation or vehicle regulation, paying attention to the environmental implications of what we do, are at stake. All the way down to the language, whether you're allowed to use the word climate in scientific documents that are literally about the environmental impact of our transportation systems. But But the other thing I would point to is the results that these civil servants working without regard to party politics have achieved. And again, there's a long way to go. Yeah, but you take again the case of aviation safety, right? Where it is difficult to think of any product from a cheeseburger to a toaster that has been subjected to a higher level of rigor and therefore has a higher number of people who have safely used it than the standard that we have achieved and are fighting to maintain for something like commercial airliners, and we've got to maintain that.
I think you can hear from this kind of conversation with the secretary that the job of transportation secretary is one of those that involves scores of disciplines. So you talk about aviation, talking about ports, infrastructure, automobiles, AI, you're talking about safety, you're talking about the environment. It really requires somebody who is a kind of polymath to be able to do it fluently. And I think we're all very fortunate to have somebody like Secretary Buttigieg doing this, and want to thank you for joining us. We're going to keep doing these things every few weeks with other members of the cabinet and other folks we think you should meet. If you're listening to this on one of our podcasts and you want to come to one of those, email us. We're doing one in September, I know, with Secretary Blinken. We did one in December with Jake Sullivan of the NSC, and we've got others coming. So if you're interested, join us. If you're here and you want to come back at one of them, let somebody know on your way out. But for now, on behalf of Mike and the New Republic and myself and the DSR Network, I want to thank you for coming, and I'd like you all to join me in thanking Secretary Buttigieg for such a great conversation.